Hello and welcome to Think Business Futures. I'm your host, Toby Hemmings. Coming to you from the studios of Radio 2 SER in Sydney, on the Gadigal land of the Eora Nation, and right around Australia on the Community Radio Network. Each week, we take a look at the numbers that make up the news. This program is made possible with the assistance of the UTS Business School. Now, it may be 2021, but the 2020 Olympics are only just about to get underway. Tokyo has been what could generously be described as a saga, with spectators now banned from attending due to COVID-19 outbreaks, and calls for the event to be either postponed again or cancelled entirely. Are the Olympics fit for purpose anymore? The Games carry cultural legitimacy, but also an exorbitant price tag. Back home, Brisbane has found itself as the preferred bidder to host the 2032 Games, with the official vote due on July 21. But is it going to be worth it? Many Sydney-siders carry fond memories of Sydney 2000, but at the same time, they also would have seen the images of rotting and rusted stadiums from Athens 2004 or Rio 2016. To discuss all this, I was joined earlier by David Rowe, Emeritus Professor of Cultural Research at Western Sydney University's Institute for Culture and Society, and Tim Harcourt, Industry Professor and Chief Economist at the Institute for Public Policy and Governance at the University of Technology, Sydney. We're 10 days out from the start of Tokyo 2020. Spectators have been banned. Opinion polling in Japan says that around 60 to 80% of the populace want the games to be cancelled or postponed. A professor of theoretical economics at Kansai University has calculated that holding Tokyo 2020 without spectators would lead to a $31.3 billion loss in Australian dollars. Tim, I guess I'll start with a broad question. Why did the Olympics cost so much money?
This Olympics will cost a lot more, I guess, because normally, as well as the infrastructure and so on, they're going to have to spend about $3 billion in sort of anti-COVID measures. And they've lost $1 billion worth of tickets, as you said in your preamble. And then, of course, they're not going to have international spectators, so they'll lose $1 billion US. They always go over budget. They say that on average, I think since 1960, they've blown out by, you know, around 172%. So they usually do blow out. They do usually go over budget. But Tokyo's got its problems in that it's got these COVID issues and they won't get the international tourists. They'll get the broadcast rights, but they won't get the international tourists, which is the local spend. And that's the thing they're battling against.
In terms of that tourist aspect, is that one of the primary drivers for the secondary economic benefits that we really see from holding an Olympic Games?
I mean, yeah, secondary benefits when you get a two-week tourism promo for your city and your country. Places like Paris and London, people go to, we know that. But for places like Sydney and Rio, you know, it is a good opportunity because people will do this, you know, once in a lifetime trip because we're far away from some of those markets. So sometimes for the Olympics, in a way, it's a coming out and joining the world. You'd rightly say that Beijing in 2008 could really say this is showing off China's economic rise and, you know, pulling. And Seoul, when Seoul joined in 88, it was South Korea looking towards a democratic future after, you know, years of being a military dictatorship. So in some ways, they do use it as a bit of a coming out parade too, and that can certainly have the eye on the tourist dollar.
The TV money doesn't go to Tokyo, it goes to the IOC, right?
Exactly.
And then the IOC dispenses the TV money in what's called solidarity payments to various national Olympic organizations, plus some extra for the host. So the major beneficiary of this made-for-TV Olympics, which is what Tokyo will be the International Olympic Committee, not Tokyo. And there's very little evidence that there is any sustained increase in tourism arising from the Olympics. Every Olympics tries to have its own kind of narrative projection of place. So it's London, you know, it's post-imperial Britain. The last time you had the Tokyo Games in 64, it was Japan is back in the community of nations. The question then is, to what extent can it control the image it's trying to project? I would suggest with Tokyo, the ultimate image that will be projected is that this is a nation state that has been bullied by a supranational body, the International Olympic Committee, into holding a games, or cornered, as one distinguished Japanese athlete said, cornered into holding the games because of the nature of the contract that the host city signs with the IOC, because most of the costs will end up with Tokyo and the Japanese national government.
What you're saying is that Tokyo is going to, and Japan are going to bear this enormous economic burden from these games. What's the role of the IOC? Are they going to, at the end of this, walk away and wash their hands? Because I think I read somewhere that the reason Tokyo 2020 is going ahead is because Japan can't afford to terminate the contract.
If they cancel it, it would cost them 4.5 trillion yen, I think. Having no spectators would cost them about a third of that. So that's a pretty big hit. Some Japanese economists said they'd wipe out all the games this year in the Japanese economy, which is a pretty big call. Japan in 2021 is quite different than the Japan of the 60s, and the Olympics is quite a different role. I think Japan would be pursuing the Olympics in 1964 to show their modern economy. Nowadays, as David says, you know, they're sort of lumbered with it. It's quite a different mindset in Japan.
The host city is not empowered to cancel the games. Only the IOC may do so. So one of the problems for the hosts is that if they did cancel the games, they would leave themselves open to being sued by the IOC. That would be a good look, wouldn't it? Suing a host city that's in a state of emergency for cancelling the games. The contract is heavily weighted in favour of the IOC. Now, I think that will have to change at various points, especially because of the decline in the number of people who actually want to host the games. Fortunately, they had 2024 and 28 locked up in one go with LA and Paris. That was a response to the fact that there was a declining number of potential host cities. And thank you, Brisbane. They sorted out 2032.
What happens to the local populations in cities that suddenly are taking on huge amounts of infrastructure for 2 weeks of sporting events?
In the case of Sydney 2000, of course, we got our infrastructure done ahead of time. A lot of it, as David indicated in his opening remarks, was infrastructure projects that were needed anyway, just happened to fit the timetable for the 2000 Olympics. So those stories have been quite good. But then you had, you know, the difficulty that Rio had and Brazil had in particular with the World Cup. I read, and David might know this, I read that there was a fella in Tokyo who'd been chucked out of his house for the 64 Olympics, you know, to build the stadium and so on. And he found a new house and he's been chucked out again. So he's been chucked out twice. That was quite a celebrated occasion. You do get these cases of some impact. On the other hand, you know, a lot of the people behind Sydney and London were trying to really think about the legacy in terms of a lot of the public housing and the infrastructure that would be left in the areas. So there's been a lot of forward thinking in terms of what's the legacy after the carnival's over and how can we use it to improve the social capital of the city.
Every Olympics now has to foreground the L word, the legacy word. The consequences of hosting a games for the local population really depends on who you are, you know, where you live, and also what your economic circumstances are. So around Sydney, also London, there were a whole series of questions about people being moved out of public housing areas or, you know, or homeless people finding themselves not exactly purged, but urged to move on. The so-called white elephant factor, you know, which everybody talks about legacy. Take the South African World Cup 2010, FIFA World Cup. I once spoke to a distinguished South African economist who said that for several of the new venues, the most economically rational thing to do would be to knock them down after the World Cup, brand new stadia, because of the cost of running, maintaining them after the World Cup, you know, would be well beyond the actual cost of keeping them going. Finally, I'd say if your program could afford it, Toby, perhaps you could fly us over post-pandemic to Athens and we could do a tour together of the rundown, the decrepit Olympic venues.
Mind you, when you do it right, it's a different story. And you know what I find interesting about the Sydney Olympics is that I was at Austrade at the time and we ran these Business Club Australias where we basically got local exporters and local small businesses in to meet international representatives. And, you know, we had an architect who we sat him next to the head of the Beijing committee for Kathy Freeman's run. And he picked up the project to do the water cube, that beautiful swimming pool in Beijing. So you put people together because it's a great opportunity over the Olympics. Then you're probably going to pick up this economics of schmooze factor that you don't normally get.
I would also mention the bird's nest.
Yes, that's a good one.
The bird's nest, which began to rust within weeks of the games being held. And I think it now might have an anchor tenant, but went for many years without an anchor tenant. So one, another of the spectacular venues in Beijing 2008, and I've been to both, and the, you know, I mean, they're both.
The cube's great, isn't it?
Yeah. Very impressive. The cube, yes, and the cube is a multi-function space and yes. So on, and
yeah, design.
How well it works. But as you say, it has to be done carefully and properly and have that legacy aspect.
The Olympics are historically almost always a net loss. If we move to the 2032 prospective bid that's going to be voted on probably within the end of the month, where it looks like Brisbane are the only candidate by the IOC that is a preferred bid, and there's every chance that they will host it. John Coates, who's the head of the AOC and a big Australian figure in IOC circles, has said that how good the Brisbane Olympics bid is in part that it'll run at about even in terms of the economic impact. If we're touting that the best we can hope for is, oh, you'll break even, why do cities want to host this event? What's the appeal of hosting the Olympics?
Well, it's the brand, getting your city and your country on the map, getting the additional trade and investment benefits and all the psychological benefits you get with country branding. LA famously used a lot of corporate sponsorship, which was usually frowned upon. And that was a legacy of Montreal trying to do it all on the public purse. So I think to some degree, the public private sector partnership was used reasonably effectively in LA. And, you know, Australia's had a good record of putting these things on, from Melbourne to Sydney with the Olympics to the Commonwealth Games that we've held quite a lot. We've got a pretty good track record. And in some ways, the types of things that Australia does well in terms of our institutions, a lot of our, you know, economics of major events is actually been quite good. So he's probably got good reason to be reasonably optimistic. And for Brisbane, you know, it's been the, you know, third or fourth tier city. So for them to get, you know, global recognition, I'd imagine that would be, you know, more beneficial to Brisbane than, say, Sydney doing it again.
In my view, there is not a snowball's chance in hell that there will be no public contribution, you know, as Coates has suggested, that the games are going to break even. I mean, there's a suggestion that it's, you know, that the feds are going to come in with half the money and the
just for the record, the yeah. statement from John Coates was yes. that the operational costs were the IOC would have a budget of 4.5 billion Australian dollars. The IOC would put in 2.5 billion of that. National sponsorship would be a billion of that. And then a billion would come in from ticketing. And so you're saying that telling is dreaming, basically?
I would say so, based on historical precedent. I mean, it would be astonishing if it did make money or even broke even. In my, you know, historically, I think that is the evidence. One of Tim's colleagues in the field of economics and accountancy once walked me through a little tutorial on how one can play fast and loose with the economics of a mega event. So there are so many things to look at, costs, you know, that have not been ascribed to the Olympics, but which are really Olympic costs. Income foregone, you know, where investment might have been more productive and so on. So, I mean, there are a whole, you know, series of questions there. There is also the side I think Tim got onto, which is Australia has a sport diplomacy policy, which has been recently updated. But a big part of that policy, which is supposed to be about diplomacy, nations getting together and, you know, all that kind of soft diplomacy of sport. But a big part of that strategy is actually Australia exporting its sporting expertise to other nations.
Yeah, it is, yeah.
Especially yeah. In its
skills.
Asian Pacific region. So it's actually an export function as well as a diplomatic one.
Exactly. Yeah, it's a good example of economic and sport diplomacy working together. The skills that we built up putting on Sydney Olympics, the Sydney Olympics were done so well that most of those people ended up running Olympics in London and Rio and China and so on. So in some ways, it's built as Australia's stock of human capital in managing mega events. And like David, I've been to, I think, you know, most of the World Cups and Olympics since 2000, and you hear Aussie accents in every headquarters you visit as a result of those skills.
How does the cost element play in when you also factor in that the audience for this sort of stuff in a way that is less tangible than TV licensing deals? Sports clips from mega events circulate on social media. The fact that, well, only yesterday morning we had people out on Lygon Street, celebrating Euro. We see this reach in terms of sport feels like it permeates across culture in a really international sense now that might not have been the same even back in Sydney 2000. How does holding an event that costs so much money to put on factor in when you think about that audience?
The regional model has been discussed in terms of mega events in order to kind of, you know, spread the risk a bit or spread the appeal. I mean, it's been, take Brisbane 2032 bid, it's been suggested that it'll be mostly held around, you know, the Sunshine Coast, the Gold Coast, Brisbane, and maybe to the Darling Downs bit. But that geographical spread is about the size of greater Los Angeles. So, you know, there's a suggestion that, you know, if you're in a mega city, it's kind of regional anyway for the Olympics. I think we've also, I don't know if anyone's watched the Euros also.
Oh yeah, too much.
I'm still in mourning here as a card-carrying Brit. We've been talking about Tokyo. Think if you look at the Euro model, you know, in 11 different countries, the Euros were held. And in the middle of a pandemic, but also in a continent where more people have been vaccinated. So, this is another model for holding a mega event, which is actually, because as you rightly pointed out, because most people will access it anyway on television, because the television sport nexus is, you know, very well established now, and I don't think you can separate them. I call it the media sports cultural complex. It's, you know, the institutions have completely converged. But you could imagine an Olympic Games which doesn't have a host city per se, or even a host region, but could be held across nations in the way that the Euros have been. You saw a mega sports event, multi-country as well as multi-city, in a pandemic, and with an admission that it will likely increase the spread of the virus, but that's not such a big problem because people have been largely vaccinated.
Interesting, wasn't it, with regional events? You know, a lot of the, you remember the Rugby World Cup in Australia? They played it all round Australia. They played one game in Launceston in Tasmania. And of course, Tassie is a Aussie rules place. And no one knew it was Namibia versus Romania. Mm. And so they said, if you live on the odd side of the street, odd numbers, you barrack for Namibia. and the other side you barrack for Romanians because no one knew who to barrack for. So they all got into it and put their colours up. So the regional, you know, and they're gonna spread the Women's World Cup around for football, for soccer,
yeah,
around the regions as well. There's a lot to be said for that in terms of not just having the big cities, you know, gobble up all the tourism. It's interesting, isn't it, to your original point, Toby, is that the, you know, the sports diplomacy, as David was describing it, it's not just mega events. It's sort of constant, in a sense, using sport as a way to make people a little bit more relaxed when they're not talking about trade and investment and foreign policy and security type issues. And, you know, Australia's always had very strong links with New Zealand and the UK on rugby and cricket and very well established events. But, you know, we've been looking for other ways to connect with Japan, you know, and with South Korea, you know, where you've got, we're both around the same level in soccer, for instance, or looking at other types of sports where we can connect with another country beyond the traditional cricket and rugby union that we're in, tennis and so on, that we're very good at it.
Sydney 2000, you know, we all have insane memories of it, myself being of the age where I would have been 6 at the time that it occurred. It permeates people of my generation's experience of Sydney and of being an Australian. As a sign of how bad lockdown's already gotten, me and my housemate put on the opening and closing ceremony the other day. There's a lot more.
Fantastic.
You think it's a bit more camp than it. It's very camp. But it's very, there's a lot of Dreiserbone in it, you know?
Yeah, which, there is. Man from Snake River.
How do you think Sydney 2000 changed? Maybe Australia is too big of a remit to ask you to think about, but how do you think it changed maybe your perception of, if not Sydney, then of Australia?
Piece of shameless advertising. I did actually write a piece on this very topic in the conversation in the anniversary last year called The Sydney Olympics, How Did the Best Games Ever Change Australia? And I called it an ambivalent legacy. And the headings that I used were a global Australia, Indigenous Australia, Sporting Australia. And I end up with the idea of the lucky games, you know, an important part of the legacy of Sydney 2000. And I think we've started to see it, especially this year, not only for that reason, but in recent times, was Indigenous Australia, the prominence of Indigenous Australia. I mean, what struck me looking back at Sydney 2000 was the very powerful role of Indigenous people and of Indigenous iconography. From the Cathy Freeman moment, which I've written about, Cathy Freeman lighting the cauldron, holding the torch, the opening ceremony, very powerfully Indigenous theming, the closing ceremony, the cultural Olympiad with its Festival of the Dreaming. I mean, that for me was really important. I mean, around the time of the bridge walk. I do think that for me is something that really comes through. It's taking a long time, as these things do, the so-called long revolution. But I do think that for me, that is something that still, I think, resonates, that it was a remarkable opportunity for Indigenous Australia to assert its demands and its presence and its endurance. That's what I most hold in terms of legacy.
Tim, how about you?
Well, I've got to confess, Toby, I actually took a job in Sydney as chief economist of Austrade in 99, so I could be in Sydney during the Olympics. And I wrote a piece very early in 99, The Economics of the Sydney Olympics, on the topic we're talking about today. And for some reason, it got picked up in the press like wildfire. So I ended up doing all this media all over the Sydney Olympics, and I think my article was released the day after Cathy Freeman won her gold medal. So it was a slow news day, and so this got picked up everywhere. So I think I've been invited to every Olympics and every World Cup and every Commonwealth Games and everything ever since. So I think it's fantastic from a personal perspective. But also, I'd agree with David on this. I mean, Well, no country's perfect, but Australia's done a lot of things really, really well. And when you look at the book, Why Australia Prospered by Ian MacLean, and you look at Why Nations Fail by the MIT and Harvard economists, when you look at institutions, Australia's actually played it very well. And to me, the optimism and the capacity to adjust society and to be very positive about society came through, I thought, in the opening and closing ceremonies, but throughout the games. And I haven't felt that good with Cathy Freeman winning until Ash Barty won in Wimbledon on the weekend. I just felt, particularly the pandemic, her win, because she's such a gracious, humble, together person and a great fighter, I actually think that was a great moment. And the goodwill towards Australians of all backgrounds, whether you've been here for 5 years or 50,000 years, everyone, you know, felt the same. So I actually thought the Olympics did encapsulate to me the sort of optimistic, sunny Australian spirit. And I found it was a win for people that recognise that Australia's not perfect. But as far as nations in the world, you know, we're clearly one that's got it close to right. We're always willing to change and think about ways we can further improve, you know, the economic and social well-being of our citizens and give everyone as many life chances as possible.
That's all for today's panel. Thank you to my guests, David Rowe and Tim Harcourt. You can catch the full show online wherever you get your podcasts. And don't forget to tell your friends or leave a review. I'm your host, Toby Hemmings. Thanks for listening.